KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I'm Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gillen.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we jump into our program today, we would like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. So be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org to hear this episode as well as other archived episodes of our Labor Radio and other labor-related podcasts that might interest you as well. So yeah, it's laborradionetwork.org. And so today we're going to talk about the large strike wave that has been capturing the country over the last few months. And so yeah, as you may have noticed or may have been aware of or even been a part of yourself, over the past few months there's been a noticeable uptick in the number of strikes and strike threats by fed-up workers that have taken place around the country. And these have spanned many sectors of our economy, from workers at consumer goods companies like John Deere and Kellogg's, to healthcare workers at Kaiser Permanente facilities in the West Coast, and nurses in hospitals in the Northeast, to mine workers in Alabama, and even to members of the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees in Hollywood. And so as a result of all of that, the labor movement itself has been getting a lot of an unusual amount of public and media attention of late. And of course, almost all the labor unrest that's taking place has been driven by the workers' desire to win decent wages and raises, to gain equitable pay structures, and also to get relief from mandatory overtime and things like that. But because of the corporate media's often spotty or ideologically slanted coverage of worker struggles in general, combined with the fact that only a small minority of Americans have any real personal experience with unions, there appears to be some confusion among the general public as to why these workers are actually being compelled to take action and to go on strike. There has really been, as I just mentioned, a concerted effort, which really does seem to be working on the part of the media and on the part of like political operatives, to conflate the current wave of strikes and labor militancy with the small number of workers that are refusing to comply with the employee vaccine mandates that are being pushed, or that is being pushed by the Biden administration, and the overall concept of, you know, either being vaccinated or tested regularly in order to continue working in your workplace. Now that is sort of what the rhetoric is, and that's sort of what the media is pushing, but that's actually not really the case. As Huffington Post labor reporter Dave Jamieson explained in a recent interview with In These Times, he said, "The vaccine is essentially a non-issue in these strikes that we are seeing. As someone who's been following the strikes closely, I have been a little surprised by the assumption that vaccines might be at the center of this, but I probably shouldn't have been. There has been an outsized media coverage of workers defying vaccine requirements, even though they seem to be quite a small share of the workforce itself." Now, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that pretty much says it all. But because of this baked-in assumption that workers are choosing to walk out of their jobs rather than get vaccinated, the labor uprising is inaccurately being associated with the right-wing anti-vax movement, anti-vaccination movement, rather than being linked to the clear workplace grievances that are being laid out by the unions and the workers themselves.
Yeah, and I think, too, there's a decent amount of misinformation going around that people are dropping out also because of, you know, extra $300 unemployment checks, yes, and things like,
yes,
that. And it's important to remember that if you're quitting your job, you don't get that,
yeah,
yeah, option available to you. And also for the people who are laid off and then maybe not choosing to go back for particular reasons, it's pretty hard to stay on unemployment for a really long period of time, especially in right-wing states like we've discussed on,
yeah,
the show before. So I think there's kind of multiple things going on here, but the vaccine part of it is huge.
Yeah, and it's, you know, like what you were just saying, not only is it hard to stay on, you know, unemployment programs, but in a lot of states it's hard to just physically access, or, you know, to actually access it. Mm-hmm. The mechanism through which you do it, whether it's an online portal or physically showing up at an office, tends to be more difficult in the COVID era now.
Yeah, yeah, but I mean, the image that's being portrayed is people who don't want to take the vaccine or lazy workers, and I think that both of those are inaccurate to,
yeah,
what we're seeing, and, you know, obviously we'll continue to talk about it.
And there really is, I mean, there is, whether it is a direct concerted effort or just sort of a nascent ideological underlying reality to it, mm-hmm, there is definitely a tendency in media and in our culture in general to sort of disconnect labor issues and people complaining about their jobs and people maybe, you know, fighting for better conditions in their workplaces, disconnect that from the reality of what it is to be exploited and be a worker selling your labor, and connect it more to people either being lazy or being entitled or demanding too much. And so to disconnect, I mean, it's kind of just the common thing that happens when covering labor issues in this country, which is to talk about whether, you know, either talk about like greedy unions and greedy workers,
yeah,
or, you know, lazy workers, and never discuss the reality of what people are experiencing and why it might be that, considering that wages have been stagnant for the last 40 years and union membership has declined, like all these things that are actually leading people to feel completely beaten down and exploited in their workplaces, that's usually never connected to the issue. It's usually talked about like, you know, people, it's usually linked to small like cultural signifiers and things like that instead.
Yeah, and I don't think that we would see nearly the staggering amount of numbers that we're seeing. You know, 4.3 million Americans quit their jobs in August of,
yeah,
this year alone. And I don't think that that's a couple specific greedy unions.
No.
That is just a large scale recognition and grievance with the working conditions that they're in.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great resignation that everybody's been talking about. I mean, this stuff is quite literally connected to the workplace and,
yeah,
how people are interacting with it and what they believe is their right. And I think it's woken people up in a lot of ways to say, oh, I'm really not in as an enviable position as I thought. And, you know, working from home, you know, did X things for me or allowed me to stay with my family or whatever options, you know, it's going to be different for each person. But I think we're just seeing, we're seeing record profits and we're seeing record, you know, stock,
yeah,
prices. And,
absolutely,
and we're not seeing that same stuff come back to the workforce.
Yeah, it's certainly not trickling down to the workers who are actually creating that value.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, like you just pointed out, I mean, there have been record or there has been like a massive increase in the people resigning from their jobs or leaving their workplaces. And for the most part, that because of the fact that there is such a small percentage of Americans who are actually members of unions or, you know, unionized workplaces, a lot of that is actually just workers who are ununionized independently deciding for themselves that they can no longer tolerate the exploitation in their workplace,
yeah,
and leaving, because a lot of the workers that are in unionized workplaces are in fact doing what we're talking about, which is, you know, taking collective action and demanding,
yeah,
better conditions or striking. So when you see the mass quittings and mass walkouts from workers, you know, who are doing it independently, those are actually just workers outside of the union sphere that are just,
yeah,
fed up and they have no other mechanism.
Well, yeah, and I feel like the thing too that I'm sure we'll touch on is that, you know, mass exodus of workers is not seen nearly as disfavorably, you know, kind of in the ethos of America than a strike.
Right.
But in a lot of cases, actually, a huge amount of turnover can cost a business even more so than a strike in which there are several concessions made and is quickly resolved.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think we're seeing, like, as these strikes are popping up, in some cases, it's really not that bad of an event for an employer to deal with a strike if they were, instead going to be dealing with a mass exodus or a mass kind of leaving of you know half of their staff or something quite large like that. So really, I think there's a change in the perception of a strike slightly. Yeah. Because really it's just a tool that's being used by a union in order to achieve, you know, improvements in the workplace. And, you know, in some cases, people are looking for more or less. And in some of those, really the outcome for the employer as well can be not as bad as yeah. just everyone quitting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, the concept of what a union does, it formalizes the process in a way. I mean, like it is organized labor because there is the understanding that there is a contract and a negotiation between the employer and the workers. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the employer will be aware, for the most part, that like the union voted to strike, and so there might be a strike coming. And so they, you know, it is almost more
well, there fair are just huge them. Efficiencies yeah. gained by yeah. a workforce that doesn't have turnover.
Yeah.
Right? Like training, bringing new people on. You know, some of the things that we've talked about at these Amazon warehouses, like you cannot... If you have constant turnover with a workforce, I mean, you just can't count on them for as much things because yeah. if they're new all the time, right? They can't kind of learn some of these inherited skills of being in the same place for a long time, and you know if they're kind of constantly moving in and out, then you all obviously have all of this infrastructure built up to train them, which you don't need as much if you have a more stable workforce.
Yeah, exactly. So in a way, I mean, really, the union the employers in this moment should recognize the value of actually having their workers unionized because it yeah. does formalize the process.
Yeah, in yeah. the context of the larger, greater resignation, I yes. do think there are some benefits to negotiating
yeah.
with your workforce as opposed to just having them all leave.
Yeah, it creates formality and stability that the employer can then depend on, you know, in a way that like just people, mm-hmm. everyone at a subway deciding to quit and walk out and having zero preparation for that would yeah. be much worse for the owner. You know?
Yeah, it's yeah. unfortunate that it has taken a kind of record change and a record shifting in the way that Americans view their jobs and like, you know, a hobbled and kind of crushed supply chain and, you know, all of these other things that yeah. have been that have had to occur to give them the leverage. But I mean... It is the state of things, and so I think it is an opportunity, and that's why we're seeing it,
yeah.
you know, happen.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it's taken a 2+ year plague to yeah. To bring this about, but at least it is in fact happening now. But yeah, I mean, just to circle back to the coverage and sort of the cultural and public understanding of what is happening right now with the mass worker uprising and walkouts. Many on the right have really been all too eager to tie these strikes and these strike threats, this labor militancy, to the workers' or rather to the right wing's anti-vaccination and anti-government ideology, which of course stands in stark contrast to the right's glaring historical antipathy towards any sort of worker action or any type of organized labor in general. You know, I mean, the right has historically and very perniciously been against the concept of like worker power and mm-hmm. unions in particular. But in this moment, when it opportunistically benefits their very short-sighted ideology, they will champion the actions that workers are taking. Which, I mean, you know, a great example of that is that many of the right-wingers were really giddy online as they watched Southwest Airlines flights get canceled around Columbus Day, or rather Indigenous Peoples Day, and American Airlines flights get canceled around the Halloween weekend, despite the fact that the pilots associations and the airlines both together insisted that the flight cancellations had nothing to do with vaccine mandates. It was still sort of that was the discussion topic in you know right-wing Twitter and right-wing you know media sphere. In fact, it even reached as high as up to Senator Ted Cruz, who tweeted that Joe Biden's illegal vaccine mandate is at work, in reference to all of the flights being canceled, which, you know, of course, was just completely inaccurate, but they will never miss an opportunity to misconstrue a moment for their own benefit. And, you know, this inaccurate conflation really allows members of the media and political operators and even just average Americans to dismiss the strikes or the strike threats or to spin them as unions being in opposition to the progressive or leftist movement rather than being an extension of it. And so it really allows, yeah, it allows everyone to write off what workers are doing as just being, oh, they're crazy. You know, it allows people who are in the center or on the left to look at the workers and say, oh, well, they're just being awful anti-vaxxers, and so we don't have to pay attention to what they're doing, or we can even say that they're bad for what they're doing, rather than looking into what it is that the workers are actually demanding. And, you know, in response to the news from August, this past August, that 70% of Portland's municipal workforce were demanding the right to negotiate over the new COVID-19 vaccine mandate that was at the time being implemented, former New Yorker journalist James Shirweki tweeted, "Organized labor has been on the wrong side of the vaccine issue almost across the board." And in the Washington Post, columnist Catherine Rampel wrote, "If big labor, you know, in quotes, obstructed this effort, it will fail not only its own members, but also the many admirers and political allies it's worked so hard to win over." Which, you know, so I think those two comments on this issue really highlight the ability and the swiftness with which this conflation of workers walking out and taking action being connected to vaccine mandates was allowed people to just completely write off what workers were doing without ever bothering to look at what the demands that are being made by the unions are, or the conditions that those workers are fighting, rising up against, or actually, you know, bothering to interview any of the workers themselves, but just to sort of paint them with a broad brush of well, they must be, you know, they must be terrible and they must be wrong because they just want to fight back against vaccines.
Yeah.
The vaccine mandate.
And in a lot of cases, I mean, these people have stuck it out, right? They were maybe not essential workers, but they probably came back early in the case of some of this kind of like food manufacturing and some of these other cases. So, you know, they went from being praised publicly and given, you know, short-term kind of overtime bonuses and really probably not enough protections, but expanded protections.
Yeah.
And then as soon as we kind of got through that, everything went right back to normal, and record profits didn't turn into higher wages or more protected work environments or any of the things that I think the majority of unions are looking for. So, yeah, I mean, I think that should be the focus of this rather than the mandate.
Yeah, I mean, you're 100% right. And case in point, a lot of the workers that are walking out and taking action are, you know, nurses and healthcare employees at places like Kaiser Permanente, you know, one of the largest healthcare providers in the country. And those are the same people that, you know, just over a year ago, we were all banging pots and pans for at 7 p.m., and you know, putting signs up that said like heroes work here and things like that, and now they're all of a sudden they're villains because they're walking out because people are misinterpreting what they're doing as being them or as them being against any type of vaccine mandate or testing requirements. And so it is like you said, it's amazing how quickly we're able to completely shift our focus away from the things that were so important to us, you know, 6 months ago, or you know, were the things that held our society together at the peak of this plague, and then just, you know, once again, as things often do, it, you know, water settles to its point and or to its lowest point, and we are back to blaming workers for their own exploitation again. And you know, there, like, it's not to say that there aren't unions making demands around the proposed requirement to have workers be vaccinated or to be, you know, tested regularly. Like, that is, that there are, in fact, unions that are doing that. But even when covering instances where unions have made demands around the vaccine, much of the media hype about supposed union opposition to mandates stems from the general misunderstanding about the nature of collective bargaining. Mm-hmm. And I will talk more about that in 1 second, but I'd just like to reintroduce anyone who may have just tuned in to this is Labor Radio. Thank you for tuning in. And we are discussing the misconception that exists in the general public as well as in the media around the worker uprising that is happening right now and misconnecting that, or, you know, misdiagnosing that as being a symptom or a response to the proposed vaccine mandate for workplaces, when really the uprising is actually to do with what you'd expect, which is demanding better pay and benefits and safer workplaces and things like that. But yeah, anyways, you know, so there is a lot of this media hype around supposed union mandates that stems from a general misunderstanding about the nature of collective bargaining. And, you know, even when an employer offers something decidedly good to employees, unions still can and really should demand to negotiate that, to get it down in writing and to formally agree to it. Like, that is the point of what a union does. So even if there is a mandate being put forward by the government to make sure workers are vaccinated, the union should, has an obligation to demand to negotiate that, to not just accept that from the employer, but rather to get it, you know, to get at the negotiating table and figure out the parameters around which that will be enacted on their membership. You know, unions that have asserted their right to bargain with employees over the implementation of vaccine mandates, like in the case of the Portland Public employees, you know, from, you know, this past summer and fall, they have inaccurately been accused of opposing the mandates altogether. And as the Economic Policy Institute's Dave Camper explained, demanding to negotiate the impact of something isn't the same as refusing to do it or even being opposed to it. At its very heart, collective bargaining isn't about money, it's about power. It's about who decides. The principle of collective bargaining is that the boss is not and should not be the unilateral decision maker. That's what a demand to negotiate means. And so, I mean, that is, it's such a simple concept because that is what the entire existence of unions is there to do, which is to negotiate anything that is being brought by the employer onto their membership and to negotiate that with them. But again, because we as a people, as a culture, have been so detached from the reality of what unions are meant to do and really have such little connection to unions themselves, it's hard for people to maybe wrap their mind around the reality that, like, unions might demand to negotiate around something as simple as a vaccine mandate. And yeah, unions seeking to bargain over vaccine mandates themselves want to determine specific policies, such as whether workers can use paid sick time to get vaccinated, what they will be expected to show as proof of vaccination, and also whether those working remotely will also need to be vaccinated as well. You know, I mean, there's many other things that may be considered, but like, those are some three pretty basic concepts that would not just be accepted as given by the employer, but rather demanded to be negotiated by a union without them necessarily being opposed to the concept of requiring workers to be vaccinated or to be tested regularly. And, you know, even in the latest version of the Biden administration's OSHA rules regarding COVID, companies that are not required to provide paid sick time for workers who test, or sorry, companies are not required to provide paid sick time to workers who test positive and are forced to leave work to quarantine.
Yeah.
So, like, that's the kind of thing that might want to be negotiated by a union in a unionized workplace. They might want to negotiate in the fact that if someone does get vaccinated and then test positive, they would and are forced to leave work, they would then receive paid sick time for that. You know, so this rule in under what the OSHA guidelines have been laid out by the Biden administration, this actually applies to vaccinated as well as unvaccinated workers alike. And companies are required to provide paid sick time to workers who are experiencing side effects from the vaccine, but not if they actually contract COVID, even if they, as I mentioned, are vaccinated. And, you know, another example of why unions would want to negotiate any mandates surrounding COVID before just accepting the terms that are laid out by employers, you know, there's language in the regulation that states paid time may be required by collective bargaining agreements or other collectively negotiated agreements. And so it is written in there that, like, unions, even though it is not required, unions may want to negotiate that. And that's written into the OSHA rules. So, of course, in a situation where an employer is saying, hey, we are probably going to be forced to implement these vaccine mandates, a union in a unionized workplace would say, hold on, we are going to sit down with you and figure out the parameters around which this will be taking place and not just accept it out of hand. And as a prime example of this, United Foods and Commercial Workers and Tyson, so the United Foods and Commercial Workers Union and Tyson Foods recently negotiated an agreement on implementation of the mandate. And after reaching that agreement, they now have reported that 96% of their employees have gotten vaccinated. So, like, it actually worked. You know, the unions demanded to negotiate it, but once they did, then there was just mass compliance. And so it's not that the unions are against it, but rather that they just want to dictate that they want to not have the terms dictated to them, but rather be negotiated. Now, you know, that's not to say that there are some unions who have been extremely vocal and adamant in their opposition to vaccine mandates. Like, we're not going to obscure that fact. There are some, but for the, like, the large majority of them are actually police unions and right-wing fire unions, you know, like those are the ones who are sucking up all the oxygen around that concept, and really kind of the only ones that are proving to be pushing back against just specifically the mandates. You know, you may remember there was a mass protest of police officers and firefighters that stopped traffic in the Brooklyn Bridge, you know, a few weeks back. And, you know, despite the fact that a lot of the same people who supported them were the ones talking about it's how it's okay to drive through protesters if they block traffic. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. But, you know, the reality is that many in the labor movement have long believed that police unions don't actually belong inside the House of Labor. We, in fact, did a show about this last year, about how police unions really do not belong in the AFL-CIO and really should not be considered part of labor, organized labor in general, because their role is really to enforce the will of capital onto working class people and onto workers. So their role is really as a gatekeeper between the rest of the labor movement and capital itself.
Well, yeah, they're just quite different, right? I mean,
exactly.
We you know, you don't see, and we used the same example last time, but you know, you don't see teachers unions kind of trying to generally protect teachers who are in conflict with students.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, with a police union, it's really their job to kind of protect an officer who maybe even in a circumstance where they, you know, used force above and beyond, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, they're just, there are specific things about police unions that cause them to be a little bit different than the majority of kind of consumer facing or kind of other, the primary unions we talk about.
Exactly. Like, yeah, you don't see a lot of examples of, like, the postal workers union protecting a post officer who, or a postal carrier who, like, kills people, you know?
Yeah, that's, you maybe hits them with their car or
right,
something
like yeah,
that. Yeah. We could use them more. Yeah, but, certainly. I think, you know, their objectives are slightly different.
Absolutely. And, you know, so that is, of course, that's where a lot of this has come from. You know, a lot of the conflation of unions being against the vaccine mandate has come from just the oxygen being sucked up, all the attention being driven by these few police unions and some fire unions that are, like, pushing back against that specifically. But they, as we just said, like, they are largely right-wing unions, like the Fraternal Order of Police, who protect violent officers and people who kill people, you know, things like that, and are generally not welcome in the House of Labor. And it's also important to note that while these police unions may be holding protests and making noise, they are not on strike and therefore completely unconnected to the current wave of work stoppages. And although they may have made a big stink about quitting en masse, there have actually to date been very few who have actually walked off the job and, you know, lost their big paychecks and their pensions and things like that. So, you know, it's a lot of hot air, but not actually a lot of action being taken. And so, you know, just to wrap this up, unfortunately, the conflation of the labor strife that we are currently seeing with a proposed vaccine mandate has largely overshadowed the important labor story that's unfolding right now, which really is that workers themselves are finding the leverage and demanding a better deal for them and for future hires. And that is what should be focused on. That's what all the attention that's being paid to labor unrest right now should be focused on the demands that workers are making and how important it is that workers are actually finally standing up. And unfortunately, the attention has just been shifted elsewhere. You know, whether that's intentional or just by how our culture works, that is, you know, that's something that is unfortunate, but hopefully will soon shift as more workers take action and go on strike. We are going to have to leave it there because we are out of time, but we will be back with you next month, the third Monday of next month. And, you know, please tune in then and go to Labor Radio Podcast Network to hear older episodes of our show. Thank you so much for listening to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Have a great night.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
Good evening, you're listening to Prison Pipeline. My name is Emma Lugo and I'm talking tonight with Mariana Bernal. Mariana, welcome to Prison Pipeline.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate being able to do this today.
Thank you. Mariana, you're an advocate for a loved one who's incarcerated. Could you tell us about that person and their case?
Sure. So my loved one is actually my brother, Stephen Bernal. He is currently incarcerated in a California Department of Correction institution. He's been there for about 20 years now. So the beginning of his story is that there was a lot of childhood.